Alabama's syndicated news talk leader, Right Side Radio. Ernie Yarbrough filling in here for Phil Williams live from the Right Side Studio. Local, state, national, all the issues, solid, conservative, and just plain right. Well, obviously, yesterday we dedicated an entire hour of this show with a call-in discussing with a lawyer who's been involved with the Dobbs case and other things, pro-life issues. Obviously, Alabama is on the record, on the books, in our laws, in our constitutional amendments as being a pro-life state. And of course, this past session was a huge debate over IVF and what happened there with a facility close to Mobile with the destruction of embryos. Is it life? Is it not life? Are we pro-life? What does that mean? How do we handle that? It was an extremely controversial situation in which myself and Representative Ben Harrison brought amendments on the floor because it was just a hard situation and we didn't know, you know, trying to handle all that and yet protect the fact that life begins at conception, right? That's what it means to be pro-life. And that's the, we think that's the only consistent position and how to work that out because you want people to have families. You want people to be able to have children. We want to have families. We want to see that prosper and grow. And as one guy pointed out on the floor, Representative Philip Rigsby, hey, we're getting into an area of bioethics. So I reached out to a friend of mine, Dr. George Grant, and he said, you know what, Dr. Joy Riley, she is the lady to talk to about this issue. Dr. Riley, thank you for being on the show and welcome.
Having me, Representative Yarbrough, I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Absolutely. We'll take a minute here. As we get into this conversation, we'll be here for this section and then back again from 3:22 or so to 3:30. Maybe just take a minute to introduce yourself, what you do, your background, and your family life to our listeners.
Okay, thank you. Well, my background is, I don't know how far back you want to go. My father was a coal miner. How's that?
Hey, there's a song about that. Proud to be a coal miner's daughter.
And I live in outside Nashville, but no one pays me to sing.
Right. Well, don't worry. I don't get paid to sing either. It turns out you can make money other ways, so it's all good.
That is a good thing. So I'm trained as a physician. I am trained in internal medicine with some subspecialty work as well. So I'm not an OBGYN, but I am an internist by training. And I wanted to understand these important issues called bioethics these days. Mm. And so I did quite a bit of philosophy during college and some in medical school. And then I went back later on and did a master's in bioethics. Mm. So I would now run the Tennessee Center for Bioethics and Culture, and I write and speak on bioethics issues.
Wow, that's fantastic. So take a minute and explain to our listeners, they may not fully understand that term, and I'm sure there's sure. terms about it that you can explain that I will certainly learn too more than what I already do, but explain what is, obviously with the evolution of technology, what is bioethics?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, it is a synthetic word, if you will. It comprises two different words, bio and ethics, and bio has to do with matters of life. And ethics is about right doing. What is the right thing to do? And in this case, it's about life matters.
You know, and that's, yeah, so it's interesting because too often we think of medical procedures, right? Hey, I need to get my leg set, or I need to... My parents have had some surgery issues recently, some health issues, and been very grateful for the ability of even the integration of robotics and the ability of modern medicine and surgery to do some amazing things. I had some friends that had ACL repairs. And so typically, right. I think when people think about, you know, doctor, surgery, medical, they don't often think of like, well, this is an ethical issue, right? They think, hey, I need to get this leg fixed, or I need to get this arm fixed, or I need to, you know, whatever. But maybe just take a minute and talk about how is it that ethics begins to tie into biology and the practice of medicine?
Well, that's really interesting because I'm actually at an international bioethics conference outside Chicago right now, and the topic is AI and medicine.
Wow.
So there is a lot of interface with bioethics and medicine from things like informed consent. What is an appropriate informed consent for any procedure? Who can give it? Who presents it? How do you go about this? So there's interplay with law as well. Ethics includes what to do when you have a medical mistake. What about children? How much decision power do they have? What is their capacity? Can they make a decision for health care? How about people with problems like dementia? Who decides? Mm. How about the end of life issues? Mm. So some people are interested in physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia. Mm. All of these are ethical issues, and they come to the fore often at the beginning of life and at the end of life, but in truth, they're throughout life.
Mm. Wow. So it's really all woven together. We actually, well, you said something there that jogged my memory. We had a bill that I was very much in favor of that was presented by Representative Chip Brown in this past session that, hey, we're going to move it up to 18 for vaccination. Like, you know, that you have to be up to 18. You have to have parental consent, not 14 or 16, but 18 for these vaccinations and shots so that we reassert parental rights. And so, you know, all that's very helpful because you just don't always realize, oh, wait a minute. You know, this is not just about getting a broken toe fixed or getting a prescription for my glasses or a colonoscopy or whatever. There's all kinds of ways that ethics and really your worldview, your moral outlook of the world impacts. I mean, another case in point that I thought of that I didn't, I know we have a mutual friend in Dr. George Grant, and he was given an amazing lecture one time where he was talking about how that it was, you know, World War I and how trench warfare kind of accidentally developed by the way that the different battles were laid out and what happened there. And then this trench warfare became a thing. And then they used science and doctors to create these gases and these just horrific ways involved with war that required people in medical and scientific expertise to be willing to use their talents and skills for things that really were kind of horrific. And even if we talk about now, as we, you know, you think about moving into like the pro-life discussion, as you said, the beginning of life. I mean, it feels like, you know, when you start talking about IVF and life, it almost feels like, you know, it's sacred, and you're kind of moving into a realm where you're putting your hand to something that is sacred and is really, really important, that if we're going to be involved in that realm, we had better be very careful about what we're doing and how we're doing it. So in that context of bioethics, kind of how does that begin to bridge into the gap of the pro-life discussion and IVF?
Good question. So IVF is in vitro fertilization, and it means people think of it as test tube babies. I always think about IVF around this time of year because the first person born through in vitro fertilization, which actually means in glass, was Louise Joy Brown. She was born the 25th of July, 1978. Mm. So it's a relatively new development, if you will. Mm. It'll be old to most listeners, but it only came, you know, near the end of the last century. Mm. So how does bioethics inform this? Well, you mentioned your worldview matters, because it does. If you only view embryos as clumps of cells, then what you do with them may not matter. But if you understand embryos to be what they are, which are earliest human forms, then how you perceive all the different factors that impact IVF and IVF itself is impacted. When Roe v. Wade was decided, they were the culture at that time was in the midst really of trying to, they were confused a bit about what the, about when life began, but we're no longer confused about that. And as indeed the plaintiffs as well as the defendants in your recent case in Alabama agreed that an unborn child is a genetically unique human being whose life begins at fertilization. And so that's a huge statement. What you do with the embryo is a conclusion that you've reached by how you view it. When you understand embryos to be earliest human beings, then you need to ask yourself the question, what do we owe them?
That's a great that's a great point. And that topic was hotly debated. We're about to have to go to a break. We'll come back and continue this discussion. But that concept was highly debated in the context of legislation that was brought in Alabama, because you know that legislation gave blanket immunity for death and destruction of embryos. We're going to come back on that. We're going to break right now and come back just a few minutes to continue this discussion of understanding that and then moving forward from a pro-life perspective. How can we utilize IVF on the one hand to see families grow, but on the other hand to promote and protect the concept of life, imago Dei, in the image of God? And that is the Right Side Way. Spanning south of Birmingham to north of Huntsville, from Tuscaloosa to Gadsden, with parts of Georgia, Tennessee, and Mississippi thrown in there for some good measure. We're back here at Right Side Radio, continuing our segment here with the one and only Dr. Joy Riley, head of bioethics and culture in Tennessee. And we are continuing this section from yesterday, talking about IVF. And so we left off there where we were talking about how does this whole idea of bioethics tie into IVF and pro-life. And Dr. Riley, you were just saying that really, if we know and that it's incontrovertible now that the embryo is the earliest form of human life, then that leads us to this conversation of IVF. And so, as I was saying, we had this in terms of how to navigate that. And that's why we had this battle where this legislation came to the floor that, hey, it's blanket immunity for death and destruction of embryos. And so obviously I personally couldn't support that. And so I brought an amendment that no immunity shall be granted to any individual who intentionally destroys the life of a preborn child. And sadly, that amendment was voted down, and that resulted in ultimately the head of ALCAP, Greg Davis, and the Baptist churches and Southern Baptist Students for Life. All these organizations wrote a letter to the governor asking her to veto that bill, and that did not happen. And I think now it's being challenged already back in courts, 14th Amendment, some folks that have got embryos in IVF facilities in Alabama because they want those. They don't want blanket immunity for that to happen. And so, Dr. Riley, just talk to us about like what are some of the inherent challenges in IVF from a pro-life perspective, and how can we navigate those successfully so that we can be both pro-life and pro-family?
Well, those are very good questions, and my answer will certainly not be exhaustive, but there are several things to consider. Once again, how do we view these children? What do we owe our children? Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's children at their earliest stages. What do we owe them? Do we owe them to be frozen? Do we want our children? Do we owe them to be put in freezers? Sometimes indefinitely. Mm-hmm. And as in the case of the Alabama recent case that went to the Supreme Court, that resulted because embryos that had been frozen were thawed, and therefore the embryos died in that process. Mm. So how you see that matters a great deal. So do we owe them freezing? When you freeze embryos and then thaw them to transfer them, because you don't transfer frozen embryos into a woman's uterus, you transfer thawed embryos. Mm. Those thawed embryos, some embryos will die in the process of thawing. Mm. So you need to realize that. Mm. So do we owe our embryos thawing, freezing, thawing cycles before transfer to uterus? Mm. There is certainly, you do not have to freeze embryos. Mm. That's not a necessary step in IVF. It's done usually as a matter of convenience and to save some money, as well as difficulty for the woman, because the woman undergoing IVF has to take a lot of hormones, both shots and pill form, in order to produce multiple eggs. Mm. You can do IVF by fertilizing only the ones you're going to implant. Mm. And some countries do this by law. Mm. You don't have excess embryos. Mm. In the early 2000s, the U.S. had, I think it was that time, over 400,000 frozen embryos. Mm.
So some countries have it by law that you have to implant the ones that you fertilize.
Yeah, actually, it's, in the U.S., you use the word transfer. You transfer it to the uterus.
Yes.
Implant is when it dives into the uterus.
Yes, thank you.
So, although in the U.K. they call it implant, so you know, it could be right if you're across the pond.
Right.
But there are excess embryos, and lots of times it's because the procedure for IVF, the cost of the drug is very expensive. Going through IVF is very expensive. So people want to hedge their bets, and they will be often talked into freezing embryos. Mm. Lots of times they don't understand at that time, it seems, that those are their children. So if you need to a mindset, you need to understand that these are your children. And I knew one couple who had frozen multiple embryos, and then once they realized these were their children, then they had them transferred. So they ended up with quite a few children.
Right. Wow.
And but they received those as children, not as clumps of cells stuck in a freezer somewhere.
Wow. Well, that's very powerful, because the reality is, it sounds like, you know, if we're going to be pro-life, that life begins, you know, at the very beginning, then that's going to change. If we're going to work that out, however that has to work out, it's going to change some of the ways that IVF would be currently practiced in America.
But it should. I think IVF could possibly be practiced ethically and well. I don't think it's usually practiced that way.
Well, and that's interesting. Go ahead.
Well, in the UK, they did their Embryology Act, Human Fertilization Embryology Act, was 1991. So in 2011, there was a study published, is in their Mail Online, Daily Mail Online paper, that in 20 years, they had formed more than 3 million human embryos through IVF. Only fewer than 100,000 of those had been transferred into uteri, into multiple uteruses, if you will, uteri. So that's like 30 embryos per transfer.
Wow. Well, we're running out of time here today for this part of the show, but that has given us a lot to think about. Dr. Riley, I'm actually working on trying to get a bioethics and IVF conversation and conference, hopefully going here in Alabama. We'll definitely would love to have you for that. Be in touch. A lot to think about, a lot to pray about. It is possible. It is possible. It's doable to do IVF in an ethical way, but it'll take thoughtful prayer and a commitment to principle to realize that all life is precious and every person is a person, as Dr. Sue says, no matter how small. Thank you, Dr. Riley. Your amazing input's been great. We're going to come back here and talk some more about the legacy of Planned Parenthood and Dr. George Grant when we come back after the break. That's The Right Side Way.